when thanks again for everyone for your time. When Carol put this lab session together and was requesting volunteers to speak, I didn't really realize what I was engaged in at that moment. So I apologize for having a third opportunity to talk with you today, but I do appreciate it. So this particular topic is about taking existing fume hoods and upgrading their performance so that they operate safely and are able to meet some of the current standards for performance, as well as enable an opportunity to reduce energy consumption. So I think Paul covered some of the learning objectives, so we'll move past that. So laboratory hoods are the primary means of protecting people from exposure. Normally this would be an animated graphic, but I don't know why it didn't show up on the system, but nonetheless. So if you look at the protection for an operator standing in a laboratory, it has lots of different devices. There's fume hoods, there's slotted hoods, snorkels, all kinds of different devices. And that exposure control device is meant to protect people from overexposure. And the design of the system has to complement that and enable the airflow to be exhausted from the building in such a way it's not re-entrained back into the air supply. And that's a very insidious problem. But the need to move the air and condition the air results in a high cost of operation. And so having had some experience working with International Institute for Sustainable Labs, I2SL, previously Labs 21, EPA, and Lawrence Berkeley National Labs, we've done a lot of benchmarking of facilities and looked at a lot of data from different buildings. And so there's a cost per square foot that's associated with labs that's significantly higher than traditional or commercial buildings. And typically we see costs as $5 to $20 per square foot. I recently looked at a building in New England that, in my opinion, set the record for what I've seen. It was $74 a square foot in terms of energy costs. So that was pretty significant. But when we look at the breakdown in these costs, we tend to see that 60% of it is HVAC, 10% is lights, and 30% plug load. Now that's different than a commercial building, which you might see 30 or 40% in the lights. So a lot of activities in lab have been focused on reducing lights and different energy use. But when we get into the HVAC, that's our biggest potential, but it's also our biggest potential for risk. And so we have to really be careful when we start looking at that. Now, if you then take the cost per operation of the building and divide it by the ventilation rate, you can get them up with a cost per CFM on an annual basis. And we're typically seeing rates of somewhere around $3 to $9 per CFM year, depending on where we are. So for averages, we just use five. In North Carolina, for some of the buildings, depending, there's lots of factors, but we pay about 4.5 cents per kilowatt hour, and it's about $4 per CFM year in the North Carolina area. So when working with LB&L and the Department of Energy, they came to a conclusion that as much as 50% of the energy was actually wasted by inefficient or ineffective operation of the HVAC systems, and that excess flow could be associated with poor design and operation of fume hoods and high air change rates, sometimes unnecessarily high. And data that we've collected has indicated that 15 to 30% of traditional fume hoods may not meet the current requirements of the ANSI Z9.5 standard for containment. And so that doesn't necessarily mean people are overexposed, but it does indicate that there's a potential for escape from the hoods. And so we want to have some level of containment that's consistent across all hoods. So looking at the purpose of the hood, you know, we have a lot of risk in labs, and that risk is the potential for overexposure to airborne hazards, primarily through inhalation. And so that's going to depend on the toxicity of the material, the generation rates, the resultant concentration, how long is that concentration going to exist in the space. And then you have some other physical hazards that may be related to dermal exposure and then fire and explosion. So the primary purpose of the hood then becomes to contain the materials that are generated within the hood, capture those materials, because a hood, a fume hood, is actually a compound hood. So you're going to contain it at the face of the hood. I don't know if you heard Jim talking earlier about the hole in the front of the hood. But we want to contain it at that point, capture it, and then effectively remove it from the hood in the system. And so for the hood to do that properly, it has to have a proper design and appropriate components. So ASHRAE 110 has provided those tools to enable evaluation of these different operational conditions, as well as the performance under those set of conditions. So if you do your inspection of the hood, you want to make sure it's got all the right components, test the face velocity to make sure that we're getting adequate velocity through the opening, look at the effect of influence of cross drafts. You know, if we have 100 feet per minute going into the face of the hood, a cross draft of 30, 50 or more can impact the turbulence of that plane. It's actually draw materials out of the hood. And then we have VAV response and stability. How often is that tested? Is it verified to be adequate to maintain containment? And is it being maintained from long-term stability? So under those set of conditions, we have to evaluate, does it actually contain? And so then we have smoke visualization for subjective evaluation and tracer gas containment for more quantitative tests. So in this case, we're generating a tracer gas, sulfur hexafluoride, nitrous oxide, to simulate a contaminant release. We use a mannequin to simulate a person. We pull breathing zone samples, and we can measure those down to about 10 parts per billion. And so with that, we have collected a lot of data. We've been collecting this data through a software system that allows us to look at that information. And retrospectively, we can go back and evaluate performance. Now, we've done over 30,000 ASHRAE tracer gas tests on hoods throughout North America. And what we did when we go back and look at that data retrospectively is we see a failure rate somewhere between 15 and 30% for a given facility. Now, some facilities do very, very well, and other facilities do really, really bad. And so what we tried to identify were what were the parameters that influenced the containment capabilities of the hood. And we found that 20% of the time, it was due to hood design. Lack of airfoil sills, the aerodynamics, the baffle settings, the edge at the bottom edge of the sash. And when we look at these components here, we can see that the bottom edge of the sash, there's potential for that roll inside the hood, very high concentration. Because of the flow separation at that point, it can escape out underneath. We can have, because of the eddies that form downstream of the body, concentrations come back toward the body, or you can simply get turbulence across that plane and escape. Now, the manufacturers have been incorporating lots of these tests to better design their hoods, and so the percentage of hoods failing as a result of design is becoming much less. However, we're still seeing lab design and the parameters associated with the exhaust system to be a very significant impact on performance. And so lab design is primarily cross drafts, location of the hood with respect to the room, and then from a system operation standpoint, the operation of the systems, the stability of the flow, the VAV response, those type of things. And then finally, work practices. 25% of the time, we find that the hoods may fail because they fail to provide containment because of the apparatus, the equipment, and the location inside the hood. Now, Dr. Knudsen, I once heard him say that you can idiot-proof the system, but you can't PhD-proof it. So work practice is a very important thing. We have to look at this holistically and bring all these things together. But there are many, many different types of laboratory hoods, fume hoods in particular. So if you look at all the different types, the sizes and depths and widths and sash opening configurations, there's no real nomenclature that allows you to differentiate one hood from another. But you can say they're traditional bypass, they're auxiliary air hood having a supply plenum above it, low velocity, or sometimes they're called high performance hoods by the manufacturers. You have VAV with a restricted bypass. What does that mean? A restricted bypass versus a regular bypass. What happens on a distillation hood that may be above on a work surface but 12 or 18 inches above the floor? And then we decided to call them floor mounted hoods as opposed to walk-in hoods. So with all these different hoods, this is a double vertical sash, vertical. This one has a combination sash. It can raise and lower as well as open and close. On these hoods that have multiple vertical sashes, each of these hoods may have different operating configurations and different ways that a user could operate the hood, and that may reduce the containment capabilities of the hood. So looking at some of the components, we have most notably at the plane of the sash, we have an airfoil sill that's meant to streamline flow into the work surface, over the work surface. We have the bottom edge of the sash, and the sash that can go either vertically or horizontal panels that can slide left and right. You'll have sometimes a sash sensor, sometimes there's a velocity through the wall velocity sensor. Hood monitor, our bypass is at the top. When you slide this sash down, you're going to get bypass flow that goes into the top of the hood. Our baffle in the back to control airflow distribution and capture through the hood. And then an outlet collar and then some type of control damper or VAV terminal. Now, users will operate the hood wherever they need to be productive. So the concept of a fixed sash height or some design opening may be compromised because a lot of sashes are designed for an 18-inch opening. But what you'll find is that users, if they're working with tall apparatus, like in this case, this gentleman is not going to be able to reach this tall apparatus. And so what he's going to be forced to do is to raise the sash fully open. And so that may jeopardize the containment capabilities of the hood, particularly if we can't respond with the flow to increase the flow as necessary. To combat that, you may have a horizontal sash, which now allows you access to the top interior of the hood without having to open up the whole sash. Right? So there's an opportunity really to get best of both worlds if you've got a combination sash. And so we have to look then at what is the performance at the full open sash? What's the design opening? Is that less than what the user opening would actually operate the hood? And we have to design for how the user is going to operate. A traditional hood typically operates around 100 feet per minute to provide containment, 80 to 120, somewhere in that range. But now they're defining high performance hoods as the ability to provide containment at 60 feet per minute in the worst case sash opening position. And so you have to compare that to a traditional hood and what would its containment capabilities be. Now in a constant volume situation, you're going to exhaust the same amount of air, and so you'll have different airflow patterns in the hood depending on sash. But that may not be influenced by a VAV, where you're going to modulate flow. Now you're going to change the internal concentrations at a constant generation rate. So if you're generating the same rate of contaminant inside the space, when you close that sash, your flow is going to go down, but your concentrations are going to go up. And that means the relative difference between internal concentration and the exposure limit is going to, that ratio is going to increase. So containment capabilities of VAV hoods have to be even better than a CAV hood because of that difference in that protection factor. Now, high-performance hoods, for lack of a different term, have been around for a long time. In the 70s and 80s, a fellow named Henry Vance was an engineer for DuPont. They designed their own hood that would operate at 60 feet per minute. They had a lab that was conducive to that operation. So it's not a new technology necessarily. But a lot of the manufacturers took note of that, and they started designing hoods to incorporate some of these more advanced aerodynamic features, enabling hoods to operate as low as 60 feet per minute. Now, some manufacturers even claim to go as low as 40 feet per minute. We've not seen a lot of good performance at that lower velocities due to a variety of factors. However, EPA sponsored a study to evaluate the different offerings of the manufacturers of these products, and they have a test protocol. It's very extensive. And with that, they put together a list of hoods that were approved for their use. And now whenever they design a new laboratory, they go to the list and say, this is one of the approved hoods, and that's what we're going to use. So there's many different manufacturers, and each of the products vary in terms of their depth, width, height, some of the aerodynamic components, and so forth. And what was interesting, as we were doing the evaluation of these hoods, we did all kinds of different tests. We did manufacturer's prototype tests. We have a laboratory in our office in North Carolina where we bring in hoods and we put them up on the bench and we can run all kinds of tests. And we've done EPA protocols on hoods and NIH and GSK, Glaxo, Merck has their own protocol, UNC has a protocol, Duke has a protocol. And we've also done a lot of field tests. There was a big study done by the University of California, Irvine, where they tested and challenged four different manufacturers' hoods comparing to a traditional hood. And with that, they use that information to get a variance from the Cal-OSHA standard, which requires 100 feet per minute face velocity. And then there was a state of Wisconsin study that looked at equivalent hood performance back in the late 90s. So just I'll draw your attention that this picture here, we're actually conducting what's called a human as mannequin test. And so I donned the apparatus, and the idea was to see what's the difference between a static mannequin and what's the difference between a person standing in front of the hood manipulating it? Now, the obvious conclusion to that was, who's the dummy? On this test here, we have a mannequin in front, but in this case, this is the NIH protocol, and it requires multiple velocity probes in the plane of the sash during the test so that you can evaluate the turbulence intensity. Now, the turbulence intensity is the variation in flow over time, and so you look at that as a temporal variation. And the idea is that if the temporal variation increases, that turbulence intensity, you're going to have a greater propensity for escape. So there's a correlation between that turbulence intensity and escape to some degree that's been demonstrated. Now, they also use box loading to simulate apparatus. Now, this test here is a walk-by challenge. What happens when a person walks by the hood? Now, I can tell you that manufacturers get very nervous when Tom Smith walks by their hood, because I'm what's considered a wide body. I can take up a lot of room standing in front of the hood, and I take up a lot of, I can move a lot of mass when I walk by the hood. So, now with this experience, we have been involved with modifications of hoods. We've made changes to the airfoil sills and the baffles, and when we come across hoods in the field that may not perform some of the older hoods, we say, well, what do we do with this hood? You know, it's, you got a choice. You're going to replace it, or can you fix it? And can you upgrade that hood in the field? And our experience testing all these different hoods has allowed us to identify the critical or key components of the performance. And when we started looking at the differences between the performance of a high performance hood at 60 feet per minute versus a traditional hood, we identified three critical components. And these are the components that definitely are what you can differentiate the different manufacturers: the airfoil sill, the sash handle, and the baffle. And each manufacturer has different variations on these themes. So we came across a hood at an EPA site, and this hood was unable to meet their criteria. And so, not this particular hood, but a hood. And so they asked the manufacturer, it was newly installed, two hoods of the new manufacturer, two hoods of the existing manufacturer, different, in the same lab. Now the two new hoods weren't able to meet the containment criteria, but the two older hoods met it fine. And so the manufacturer came in, they said, look, it's not a problem with the hood, it's a problem with the lab design or the airflow controls and a whole variety of other reasons. And so he refused to do anything in terms of repairing the hood. However, they needed to operate these hoods. So they asked us, they said, could you evaluate this? And so we worked with the manufacturer of the other hood and said, can we borrow some of the components off your other hood and put them on this hood over here? And they said, sure, we'd be glad to do that. So they came out and took some measurements, and they cut their parts and pieces, and they fitted on the other hood, and lo and behold, it worked. So EPA said, huh, this is interesting. You just took a hood that didn't perform, and you used some of the components off another people's high-performance hood, and all of a sudden it worked. They said, this is something we want to study. So they sponsored a research project. So we evaluated all kinds of different manufacturers' hoods and decided what could we do to make those old hoods work. And so we came up with some components that allowed us to basically retrofit or upgrade a hood and make it able to contain at lower face velocities by adjusting these three critical components: the airfoil sill, this bottom of the sash handle, and the baffles in the back. So these three component parts were then addressed so that we could modify multiple different manufacturers' hoods that may have been different models for many different years, and each one has to be kind of custom fit for the different model, but once you have a similar model, then it's just about replicating it. And so it's basically what we call a vortex displacement sash handle. What that does is, it, as you get the roll behind the hood, behind the sash, it dilutes and displaces that vortex away from the edge of the sash so that the concentrations are reduced right behind the sash. The airfoil sill helps to streamline it by having multiple vanes. And then the baffle in the back of the hood helps to control the distribution within the hood itself. So these components work together. And with these three components, you can basically reduce the flow by as much as 40%. And that allows equivalent or better containment than way it may have operated at 100 feet per minute. So the nice thing about it is that it's very easy to install. You can do it in less than half a day. And the cost on it is very reasonable, so that you get a very quick payback on it. Typically, 2 to 5 years is where it was positioned, so that it could operate with both CAV or VAV hoods without impacting the operation of the controls. All you do is do a flow adjustment. So here's a hood before, and you can see it's pretty dingy and dirty. It didn't have some of the aerodynamic components. The light wasn't functioning in it. And so our team went into that hood, cleaned out the inside of the hood, decontaminated it, and then installed a LED light. We installed the components, and when the users came back, they thought they had a new hood. But in fact, you can tell by the stickers on them, they were still the same hood. Right, so this enabled a couple of advantages for the facility. One, they got an opportunity to reduce their flow and reduce their energy consumption. They also had assurance that this hood, this renovated hood, would work as well as any new hood that they would install. So health and safety was excited about that because they said, now I don't have concerns. That old hood delivers the same safety as the new hood. Now everybody lives on the same playground. And then from the researcher standpoint, they didn't have to experience a lot of downtime associated with the replacement of the hood. Now sometimes hoods do need to be replaced. But to validate this, we had to go through thousands of tests. There was manufacturer tests, and then we had to test them installed, and then we had to test them under as-use condition, subject to all these different test protocols by independent testing. And it was really very interesting, but the retrofit kit really improved the performance of the hoods over the existing hood prior to the modifications in nearly every case. Now, this is kind of an interesting development. This is the fog generator that is associated with the Public Works and Government Services of Canada. And basically by generating a controlled distribution of fog through this generator, you're simulating the tracer gas release. And this has worked very, very well to test hoods. And so if you want to see how to easily test a hood to check to see if it's going to contain visually, this is a really good test to run. It's very inexpensive. And so it's been basically brought into their standard. And now everyone doing a smoke test can do it exactly the same way. Same challenge, same way of evaluating the hood, and the cost of it is obviously very, very cheap with respect to doing tracer gas. Now, I'm not saying it eliminates the tracer gas test, but it alleviates some of the need for it because now you can identify very significant problematic components, and then once you've eliminated those, then you can run your tracer gas test to validate it. Now, candidates for retrofit. Some of the candidates for retrofit are any traditional bypass or auxiliary benchtop hood, CAV or VAV, horizontal, vertical, or combination sashes. However, it must be of good integrity. If the parts and pieces on that hood are corroded or they are missing components and so forth, that may not be a good candidate. Now, the other hoods, like a student workstation that has no traditional bypass, that's not going to be a good candidate for retrofit. And this hood is made out of wood. All right? We generally are not going to recommend continuing the use of that wood hood. All right, that was installed in like 1910, and the technology's advanced since then. So certainly hoods that have to be removed. So in an investigation, you have to make a distinction between what's a candidate, and then if it is a candidate, are you doing it for safety, or are you doing it for energy savings, or are you doing it for both? One of the other features that we found is on a vertical sash hood, if you have a sash height restriction, if operators need to open that sash, then we put in a horizontal sliding sash panel, and again, this is supposed to have been an animated graphic, but essentially these horizontal panels actually fit just directly behind the vertical sash. So your vertical sash can still raise and up and down, but the panels slide back and forth. So if you need access to the hood, you can raise it full open, but not require additional flow. So you can operate at a velocity of 60 feet per minute, the flow equivalent to 60 feet per minute, but you'll get, like, say, 100 feet per minute with the horizontal panels in place. Now, what this does also is in California, there is a requirement, Cal OSHA requires 100 feet per minute face velocity. So in this case, you can ensure that by retrofitting the hood, you'll get containment at 60 feet per minute, but with a horizontal panel in there, it'll operate at 100 feet per minute. Right? So you're getting the equivalent savings of 40% flow reduction without the loss of the face velocity, and you don't need the variance from the Cal OSHA law. So it helps to kind of match that. And we developed this for University of California, Irvine. So now, when you make a choice between replacement versus retrofitting, a replacement, typically a high-performance hood is about $1,500 a linear foot. So a six-foot hood is going to cost around $9,000. A study done by a university in New England found out that when they include the cost of disconnecting the ductwork, all the services, the plumbing, the electrical, and all of the controls, taking that hood out, bringing the new hood in, reconnecting all the controls, and then having it testing, was as much as $50,000 per hood. And it was either several days to several weeks of downtime for the users. They had to clear out the entire hood, all of the cabinetry, all of the space around that hood so they gain access to it. And then there was scheduling of all the different trades. Whereas what EPA was saying is that, hey, we could, instead of taking that hood out, we can just retrofit it, and now the downtime is 3 or 4 hours, and the cost is about $6,000 or something like that installed. So it's about anywhere from a third to half, sometimes as much as a tenth of the cost of the actual replacement of the hood. So that was something that EPA was pleased with and that they were able to replicate. So we've done hundreds of hoods for them at this point. Now let's move on to VAV. So if you've now said, okay, we can reduce the face velocity when the sash is open from 100 down to 60, what can we do if we reduce the sash? What's the minimum flow that we can achieve? But we have to know that when we move that sash, it's going to contain when the sash is open, it's got to contain when the sash is closed, and it's got to contain during the movement of the sash. And so these components of the interior of the hood have to be coordinated so that when you reduce that flow, you still maintain containment. So many different monitors and control types. You've got flow monitors and face velocity and pressure and different flow control types as through the wall velocity, sash position, occupancy, manual, on-off, or occupied, unoccupied. We generally don't recommend an on-off. And different modes of operation, two-state, full VAV, VAV hybrid. So they can get very, very complicated. When looking at the min and max flow, when the sash is closed, we're at some flow, and then we raise the sash and the flow increases, and then we have to make sure that we get stable flow while the sash is open and closed, and we'd like to get repeatability. So our issues then, our specifications have to be centered around what's the min flow, what's the max flow, what's the response time, typically less than 5 seconds, and what's the allowable variation in flow, which is an indicator of the tuning of the controls. And so how many people actually measure those parameters when they're setting up a VAV system? Okay, a couple, right? So it's very important. It's not hard to do. But that minimum flow has gone through some variations over time. And so currently, the current standard is Z95, which says it must be appropriate. But then it says you could consider other facilities have used values between 150 error changes and 375 inside the hood. Now, you compare that to what the lab is, 4, 10, 12, something like that. We're order of magnitude greater than those flow rates through the interior of the hood. But we want to prevent the accumulation of unsafe concentrations and the potential for an explosion. So by measuring the bottom velocity, by measuring the velocity in the bottom slot of the baffle, you can measure of the velocity that is proportional to flow. So as you raise and lower the sash, that flow will change, and that velocity will be in direct proportion. So by using the same probe, if you hook it up to a transducer, you can then look at the variation in flow as you raise and lower the sash. If you do 3 cycles of that in a 5-minute period, 30 seconds closed, 60 seconds open, 30 seconds closed, then you see the response time and the stability of that flow over a period of a couple of cycles. So it's an easy test. When you get poor performance, where you get hunting and seeking, and it's not matching a consistent flow, or the response time is compromised, then you have to say, well, what do you do about it? And you can try and tune those controls. Maybe it's got a PID loop on there, and you can set those settings. How many people have tried to tune a PID loop? Successful? Difficult? Absolutely. Yeah, very, very challenging. Well, in some cases, you may find out that those controllers may not be capable of being tuned properly. So what do you do then? Do you take the whole controller out and put in a new terminal? Or can you do something else like an upgrade? And what if the controller itself doesn't have the sensitivity to go to the lower flow that you want to operate? Again, do you replace it or retrofit it in place? What can be done? So in this particular case, this facility had some pretty old conventional commercial grade controls. And what we found out was that the operation of that system was really limited by the pressure transducer. It was a commercial grade pressure transducer, had a very low, inadequate sensitivity. And their actuator was not a high speed actuator. So by replacing those components, just those two components, the actuator and the static pressure sensor, they were able to get much better sensitivity and lower flow. And so the controllability was improved without the cost of taking it out and putting it all back in. So it's an option to consider on renovation projects where budgets are constrained. Obviously, we want a brand new system. We'd love to have a brand new system and have all the controllability, but sometimes there's factors that may limit that that potential. So where EPA went with this again is they said, well, if we've got all these facilities, they have about 38 facilities in their portfolio. They said, if we're looking at upgrading energy and reducing energy but improving safety, we've got to look at a strategy to kind of renovate. And so taking the fume hood retrofit along with an upgrade of the VAV terminals, they make a determination. If it's constant volume, they put in new terminals. If they if they've got a hood that's lost, you know, it's past its salvage value, they'll replace the hood. But in the cases where they can renovate them, they'll do that. And so they'll combine it into one project, retrofit the hood plus install new VAV controls. So there's a cost associated with that. And when we looked at this, so here's a retrofit on a CAV situation. From a CAV standpoint, we start with 1,000 CFM, and we go down to 600 in this particular example. It's going to be different for every hood, different size hoods, different opening areas. In this case, we reduce the flow by 400 CFM. At $5 per CFM year, we've saved about $2,000 a year. That's a 40% reduction, and it cost us, in this case, about a $6,000 investment, and that's about a three-year payback. That's pretty good by anybody's standards as far as a competitive payback. If you were to replace that with a high-performance hood, you're going to get the same savings, except now we have a minimum cost of around $15,000 or $16,000. And as I mentioned, one university said it was $50,000 or $60,000. So that payback now goes up to about 8 years or more. If you took a fume hood and you went from a constant volume and you converted to a VAV, I don't want to get into Wellen's whole discussion here because I know this is a good lead-in for you, right? So our cost we looked at was we're going to save about 56%, so the flow reduction is going to be greater on average for the annual year. But the cost is going to go up because we have to now do the exhaust valve for the hood and the exhaust or the supply valve for the lab, and maybe there's a general exhaust and then VFDs and other parameters to make the whole system VAV. So that cost goes up. Typically, we put it at about 8.9 years. For the retrofit plus the VAV, some of those componentry already comes with the retrofit kit. So what we get the most savings, 65%, I think that says 66%, and the payback was about 8.3 years for this. Now, these are general, and they're based on some assumptions that the sash was open 25% of the time and closed 75% of the time, but you got to run the analysis and do the feasibility analysis for every facility. So this is just in general. So that brings us to the end. Any questions on that? Yes, sir? Okay.
Gwellin, Pagliaga, Taylor Engineering. On that last slide, you were referring to my presentation on the full VAV retrofit. It seems to me that your payback analysis on that is missing the savings that come from the room being VAV. You're taking account for the airflow savings of the reduced hood airflow because it's a VAV hood, but once you've put in the VAV control for the room supply and general exhaust, the room can then modulate VAV from, you know, its design airflow down to its minimum air change rate, and that's an additional $5 per CFM per year. I agree with that number. That makes that whole package more cost effective, and we find that more in the 5-year payback range generally. High capital cost, but reasonable payback also. And I'll be presenting on that. But
well, I'm going to leave it to you to present that. This was a very simplistic example just to show that there were some economies there and that those factors have to be included. But you're absolutely right. I look forward to how you include all those savings to make the case better. Any other questions? Yes, sir?
So Jim Bolton, so I was kind of curious if you look at sash controls, automatic position of the sash itself in your analysis.
Yeah, so we have not. We have a lot of experience with sash closure devices. Fundamentally, I don't have any issues with the theory that if somebody walks away from the hood and the sash is closed, that's a good thing. We like to have the sash closed. That's probably a safer way to operate the hood. However, in practice, I can give you two sides of this side. One, we find that researchers, because they are innovative people, they don't really like to have the sash closed on them. They like to be in control of that, and they tend to override it. And some of those systems are less intuitive than others. LBNL did a big study on this. A woman named Laurel Davis recently published or presented a paper at AIHA. And she did a lot of research on it. It's something you should really check into. From our standpoint, as a service company that goes in and tests hoods and likes to help them make sure that they continue to function properly, we love the sash closure devices because it gives us something to fix. A lot. So I can give you both sides of it. You know, on one side, I can definitely see the value. On the other side, there's also an enhanced maintenance item to it. And I think that facilities are burdened as it is trying to keep the simple stuff working. And if we add layers of complexity on top of it, not just a bad thing, it just has to be accommodated in terms of a ventilation management program. And the real costs have to be factored in. So, yeah, that's my basic answer to that. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your time. This will be the last time I speak today.